Welcome to Adult Siblings Versus, a podcast where a grown-ass brother and sister put aside their childhood rivalry in order to review nostalgic pieces of pop culture. I'm your co-host, Jason S. Leverett.
And I'm your other co-host, Ariel Leverett.
Boy, howdy. Ariel, Disney is not doing very well in the early 2000s.
Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. I have feelings watching this.
So far, like, the whole decade just seems to be, you know, the Black Cauldron instead of just one film. And, you know, if it wasn't for Pixar, then Disney would have been in serious trouble during the 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's generally agreed that Disney kind of took a dip during this time. Like, but yeah, to re-experience said dip is interesting.
It's gonna get better for Disney, because the next movie that we talk about next time is legitimately a hit for them. But that's not what we're talking about today, because today we're talking about Atlantis, The Lost Empire, otherwise known as Atlantis, the lost movie that you forgot about.
Atlantis, a colonizer's adventure.
Atlantis, the prequel to Avatar. So Atlantis is a movie I kind of remember liking at the time, but I think I liked it because it felt so different than what Disney was doing at the time. And, you know, they're not really all that related at all, but I think I have some weird connection between this movie and then Titan AE, which came out the year before. It kind of felt like animation was kind of taking an animated film specifically, were taking kind of an interesting turn. But then I think if that's where animation was attempting to head in the early 2000s, it kind of ended up crashing into the sea, and instead Shrek kind of dictated where things are going from now on. Because I think Treasure Planet may also kind of fit into this sort of adventure animation genre but not musical, that we're kind of seeing in these three movies. But I actually don't remember watching this movie that much, even though I know I've watched it, but I don't remember, like, watching anything close to, say, The Emperor's New Groove.
Yeah, we definitely had it on DVD. I remember liking it pretty fine, but it seems like this was definitely one of those DVDs. I always have this horrible problem, and it went from, like, our own, like, home collection of movies to Blockbuster to now all the streaming services that I use, where, like, I will just stare at a list of movies that I have access to and, like, not be able to pick. And it's like, there are a bunch of movies that I technically do like, but I'm just like, no, I don't feel like this one. And I feel like Atlantis was one of those movies where, like, I technically liked it and enjoyed it, I'm pretty sure, like, when it came out, but it was very rare that, like, when it's like, I'm gonna watch a movie, like, it was one of those movies that I would just stare at and be like, but not this one. Like, every once in a while I would rewatch it, but, like, it was not a go-to in any way.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about Atlantis as we continue. Oh, I should probably specify, folks, I apologize, but we are in the midst of revisiting the Disney experimental era, the time post-Disney Renaissance, but before the Disney revival, that we have not agreed on when that starts. Like, we are in contention. Also, we skipped Dinosaur, which was, like, the first proper non-Fantasia movie of this era, and I feel pretty good about the decision of skipping Dinosaur. But
yeah, like, we only have so many years in our lives, and we can't just be, like, tossed around watching Dinosaur, like, higgledy piggledy. We gotta live our lives.
Yeah. So last week, obviously, we did Emperor's New Groove, and now we're doing Atlantis, The Lost Empire, not The Lost Kingdom. That's Jurassic Park, I think.
Sure.
Jurassic World? I don't know, man. I don't know. I didn't like that movie. Anyway, But we're going to talk about Atlantis in greater detail. I don't have the book of information that I had about this movie like I had with Emperor's New Groove. No documentaries needed to be watched for this film, I will say. But I do have a little bit of stuff to talk about. But if you want to join the conversation, haha, see what I did there? That's a real podcaster term. Yeah, you want to join the conversation, go ahead and email us at adultsiblingsversus@gmail.com or tweet at us at adultversus on Twitter, or you can find us under the name Adult Siblings Versus on Facebook. So Ariel, you talked a little bit about it, but any more memories or nostalgia about Atlantis, the Lost Empire, before we get into the nitty-gritty?
I think I remember like liking like the visuals of like Power Source Kida, but like, and yeah, I don't know. I feel like I think the reason why this movie probably did not have like as much of an impact on me as a youth is that like I feel like there's nothing in this movie to like get me like really like emotionally connected. Because it doesn't have any songs. So, like, I can distract myself hardcore with a movie, with a cartoon that has, like, songs that I'm really into. Because, like, I myself am just really attached to music. But it doesn't have that. But it also doesn't have, like, the comedy fun to, like, to a very large degree that I could attach myself to. Like, say, with Emperor's New Groove. So I think, yeah, I think that's why it's, like, not, like, a big memory about it. Because it doesn't have, like, the things that, like, would make me super invested in the movie.
So what you're saying is you only like animated films that have either have musicals, music numbers, or are funny. And if they don't have those two things, then get the fuck out of here.
Well, I think probably there is also the room for things that, like, I mean, just have, like, a strong emotional pull. Comedy is a good example. But, like, also, you could have, you know, except, you know, with Pixar, they give you the emotional pull that isn't necessarily comedy. But, like, you damn sure you got feelings. But, like, yeah, you don't really have that so much in Atlantis. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm just like, yeah, I was just fine with it as a kid.
Sure. I remember liking it, but I guess I didn't like it enough to, like, feel super invested. I haven't really revisited it since those days either, so.
Yeah, once again, because, like, we talked about this before, like, you know, upon access to Disney Plus, you know, like, I felt the need to revisit some Disney things that I felt nostalgic about, and it did not even occur to me to think about Atlantis.
Well, I mean, that's not fair for me, because the number of things that I could have revisited, I definitely did not. I mostly revisited X-Men the Animated Series and Gargoyles. Mm. And then I was like, oh, I got the new DuckTales on here. I'm going to watch it. Mm. So
the funny thing is,
I did not revisit the old DuckTales at all.
Sure.
All right, so let's go ahead and actually talk. I feel like we might be trying to waste time and not get to this. So we're going to, you know, bite the bullet. So Atlantis, The Lost Empire is a 2001 movie directed by Gary Trousdale and Kirk Wise. If you're a longtime listener of this podcast and those names sound familiar, that's because they are the directors of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. The screenplay is by Tab Murphy, and the story by credit from it goes to Wise, Trousdale, Murphy, but then also Joss Whedon, Bryce Sabal, and Jack Isabel. I'm not 100% sure what that ends up meaning for every single person on that list. I can at least speak on a little bit of Joss Whedon when we get to that point. Anyway, the budget for this film is somewhere between $90 to $120 million. I heard $100 million might have been where it was. Mm. The gross was $186 million. Now, that is higher than The Emperor's New Groove, which I think was like at least $20 million less at the box office. But there's a decent chance that it was also cheaper than this movie. So, but either way, still a pretty big disappointment. Didn't even break 200 million. That is definitely not what Disney wanted for Atlantis. Like, there's probably a couple reasons for that. Like, one, I don't think people understood what this movie was. It was not your typical Disney adaptation of a fairy tale slash story slash grossly inaccurate history in as far as Pocahontas goes. And it didn't really seem like it was like that Oscar chasing type of film that Disney had been doing so much of in the kind of later end of the 90s. But then also, it did open up opposite Lara Croft Tomb Raider. And it definitely opened up at number two to Tomb Raider's number one. So that might have been part of it. Also, I was this weekend year old when I realized that Lara Croft Tomb Raider is 21 years old. And that was a little bit of a bummer to realize. Ugh.
Well, here we are. Here we are.
Yeah. Time makes fools of us all. So, how did this movie come to be? Well, the film was conceived back in 1996. The directors of Hunchback, you know, Trousdale and Wise, they're having lunch with their producers on the film, and they're saying, you know what, we want to keep the crew together. We want to keep the team that did Hunchback together to make a new film project. And they decided that they wanted to make a film that is inspired by Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Or is it Under the Seas? I never know.
I think it's singular.
Sometimes those old-timey books have weird names that don't really match up with my idea of grammar. I'm just going to look it up really fast because it's going to bother me for the rest of the thing if I don't confirm.
Well, I'll be excited if it's singular because they're like, oh, yeah.
It is plural. 20,000 Leagues Under the Seas.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well,
yeah, this happens a lot. Like, you feel like you have like an idea of a title for these old timey books, and then you actually check out the title, and then here we go. Here's a funny. This is why. Apparently, there was a mistranslation of the title that made it say Under the Sea when it came to English.
Okay, so there is a good chance that I have seen it say a singular, like. In singular form.
I would argue that you probably have exclusively seen it as the singular.
Okay.
Your whole life.
Okay. Well, that makes me feel better. I didn't want this to be a Myers situation.
Yeah. Walt Disney's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, 1954. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. Adaptations of it, they're all saying the same thing. It's Under the Sea. The original book is Under the Seas, but it was probably translated to America as Under the Sea, and then all these adaptations are based off of that title, so that's why. Okay.
If you want to learn more about this, listen to the song Under the Sea from The Little Mermaid.
If you're interested in 20,000 Leagues Under the Seas, check your local library. All right, anyway, back to the conversation at hand. So they decided they want to make a movie inspired by 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and or Seas. I haven't read, so I'm not going to lie and try to talk like an intellectual here. But apparently, while Atlantis is featured in the story, it is not featured heavily. It's not explored that much. So the idea with this movie would be, let's make a story about Atlantis where we actually get to see all of Atlantis and spent a lot of time there. So that was the crux of that. Or it might have been something else that may have inspired them. We'll get to that in a little bit. Put a pin in that, folks. But the big plan was to make an adventure story. Specifically, they wanted to make a big adventure story, not a musical. It was very explicitly they just wanted to focus on action sequences and adventure stuff, not the music. And this was a challenge because, especially at this time, Disney animators were just not used to doing that. They're used to doing musicals. Like, the only non-musical that's really happened with traditional animation was Emperor's New Groove, and it was supposed to be a musical. It only changed, like, midway. Mm. So this might be the first time in, like, since, what, The Rescuers Down Under that they hadn't done a musical. Like Tarzan was kind of not a musical, but it was kind of a musical. It was all the music was just being sung by an unbodied narrator who was detached from the action and from like the plights of mortal men, aka Phil Collins.
Yes. The usual role he takes in the universe.
So we mentioned Joss Whedon, and I think I made a bigger deal about it last time. You know, it turns out it's not as interesting as all that. So Joss Whedon was the first person who wrote the script to this film, and I will point out. So Joss Whedon is not he's currently in movie jail as we record this, after some unpleasant accusations came up of him during the filming of Justice League, and then that led to some accusations of his entire career, which may have painted him as potentially racist, but also probably abusive to actors. Mm-hmm. And also possibly sexist, which is the exact opposite of the image that he had been portraying for himself for like 25 years. So that's all sad. But during this time, he's kind of everywhere. He's got his toes in a lot of different projects all across the world, like in all sorts of things. But I know for a fact that Whedon is a big fan of the concept of animation for adults that's not like, you know, porn. Like that's what, when you say mature audiences for animation, that's kind of what the first thing people think about. There's not a whole lot of, or comedies. Like either comedies or it's something sexual. Like you're going to have a cartoon cat trying to get laid. And everyone's an anthropomorphic junkie or something like that. It's this weird stuff. But I know Whedon was a proponent of the idea of doing that. He had kind of said that, I'm not sure if I'm the person to direct such a thing, but I think between the fact that he wrote this screenplay and that he also had a strong hand in Titan AE, which would have been around the same time in pre-production. I mean, like he definitely seemingly like was trying to try his best to do it. But maybe the reason that he decided he's not the person to do it is because of what happened here, because he wrote the screenplay and then when he turned it in, they apparently tossed it into the garbage or something. He says that they didn't use anything from it.
Really? Because I did definitely wonder if Audrey was one of his creations, because it's like young girl mechanic, maybe think of Kaylee from Firefly.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good point. He might have been being hyperbolic when he said that they didn't use anything. But we don't have access to his original script, so it's hard to know what did and did not make it in. But whatever was turned in was heavily retooled and rewritten by Tab Murphy, who has the proper screenwriter credit on this film. The version that Murphy turned in was 155 pages. They compared that to the typical Disney film of 90 pages, which I thought was crazy considering what I had just watched. But apparently the director slashed much of that script and put more focus on Milo at the expense of cutting out characters and cutting out sequences. And then this resulted in Atlantis being introduced a lot earlier in the film than was originally intended. And I think you can kind of feel that when you watch this. It feels like Atlantis comes in. I don't even know if it comes in early, but when Atlantis comes in, you check the time on the movie, it's less than an hour left, and you're like, huh, that's not a lot of time to explore Atlantis and also have a climax.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of the journey to get there, and then, yeah. A lot of things have to happen quickly.
You might see me revisit this point when we start talking about the movie itself. Anyway, Mike Mignola, who I don't know if you're familiar with him, Ariel, but he is the creator of Hellboy.
Oh.
He was brought on as one of four production designers for the film, but really it seems that his designs were the most heavily used in this film. Like you can, if you're familiar with his artwork, and I'm not just talking about like the live action movies because I think they had to change some stuff to make it work. But if you've ever seen his like Hellboy comics or anything that he's done in the comic book world, you can kind of see his fingerprints all over all the designs of Atlantis, the designs of the machinery. Like it really feels like once you know it's him, you're like, oh, that makes perfect sense. That those exactly like his stuff. Like, and indeed, I would say his designs were the most praised part of this film. Like, it seems like that's what everyone agreed was the good thing about this movie. Now, Mark Okren, I'm not sure if you know him either, Ariel, but he is famous for creating the Klingon language.
Oh.
He was brought in to design Atlantean for this film.
I am fascinated with that job. Like, I always find it funny when you have, like, you know, you go to college for whatever thing. So it's like, you know, you go to college, you're like, I'm going to study linguistics. And, like, your parents are like, what are you going to do with that besides be, like, a professor? And, like, I just think it's just, like, such a funny thing, the way you could, like, use those skills in, like, in Hollywood and make your own language and stuff. It's fun. I think that's interesting.
So one last point I want to bring up before we go talk about the movie is that we have a Lion King situation here.
Ooh.
And that Disney was accused of plagiarism due to how similar Atlantis, the Lost Empire, was to an anime called Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water.
Hmm.
Now, I'm going to be... upfront with you guys, despite being a big anime fan and have been for many years, I have not seen Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water, although I am familiar with it. It's actually one of those, like, perfect moment in time anime that is historically relevant, but I can totally see people not seeing it because it was a collaboration between Hideaki Anno and Hayao Miyazaki. So, like, you know, Anno being very famous for Neon Genesis Evangelion. And Miyazaki being, you know, Miyazaki. We all know who Miyazaki is. Yes, the creator of Kiki's Delivery Service and other movies, I guess.
Classic masterpiece, Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yeah. So I haven't seen Nadia, so I can't speak to this accusation. But apparently there's a lot of similar imagery and designs that supposedly Nadia would have done first. The creators of Nadia wanted to make a big stink about it, but NHK and Toho, the companies behind Nadia, were not interested in getting into a legal battle with Disney.
I mean, that's fair.
Apparently, you know, the creators of Atlantis had said that they never even heard of Nadia until production had been over for a while, and said that, like, you know, we both based our things off of Jules Verne, so that there are similarities is probably because of that. But it has been noted that a lot of the similarities that both of these products have is based off of stuff that was not in the original story, like power crystals, for example, and just certain design choices at all, like, or just that. So who knows? Now, I made a big deal with Lion King to say that I felt pretty confident that Lion King did not necessarily rip off Kimba the White Lion because of just having forced myself to get exposure to Kimba the White Lion. That fucking show is bonkers. And I just think that a show that's on that as long as it was, that's in the same setting, is kind of bound to have some similar themes and even some designs. I mean, there's only a certain amount of ways you can draw a warthog. And yeah, hyenas make great villains. I'm sorry. They just do. But I cannot speak to it on this front because I just don't know enough about Nadia. Because I'm a bad anime fan. Bad classic anime fan. Also, funnily, they said that they may have ripped off of Stargate with the character of Milo, as he's apparently resembles very heavily the main character of that movie, Daniel Jackson, who, and then there's the irony that movie got a television spinoff, and that television spinoff got its own spinoff called Stargate Atlantis. So I don't know what any of this means, but it sure sounds interesting.
You know, you talk about it with the right rhythm and everyone's going to be like, ooh, yeah, yeah.
But bottom line, where there's smoke, there's fire, is as they say. And this is not the first time that Disney's been accused of this. So this is, you know, not super great for them. Anywho, Ariel. So I was trying to watch Atlantis, but then I realized that there was like a a dark-skinned woman hanging around the place I was working, crawling on all fours, being very animalistic, and I got very distracted by the depiction of dark-skinned women in my apartment. So I ended up not paying attention much to the movie. But I did use my Whitey powers to save her culture. Ooh. But can you please tell the folks at home what happened in this film?
God, way to lead me in. I'm going to swallow my opinions for the time being and just talk about the plot for a second. Jesus Christ. All right, so the movie, kind of the cold open, takes place thousands of years BC in an area that we do not know. There is Atlantis that is currently above the water, but something is happening, and there's a big wave that's coming towards the city, and destruction is about to happen. Everyone's trying to get away, and you see the king of Atlantis with the queen and their young child, Kida. They're trying to run away. But something calls to the queen. Her eyes glow, and she lifts up into the light coming from above, and she somehow, using the power coming from above that we will learn more about later, shields the heart of the city, like the center of the city, and protects it from the big wave, and it goes under, and that's your cold open. Then you see we jump forward to 1914 in Washington, D.C., where all the cool museums are, and we meet Milo, who is a scholar. He's an academic, but is not doing
nerd.
A raging fucking nerd. So they put him where he belonged, in the basement.
In the basement.
Yeah.
Nerd.
God,
nerd.
I am not.
Nerd.
That's really good. I am not looking forward to having to cover Revenge of the Nerds one day. Anyway. So even though he clearly is not at all respected in this museum and seems to be, I don't know, paid as the janitor. Like, it's very confusing what exactly his job at this museum is. But he's like...
Very unclear.
Yeah, he's working on his big speech because he wants to go on this exhibition related to Atlantis, and he has his pitch that he's given to, like, the board of the museum or something like that. But they don't like him, and they cancel his meeting, and they're like, you're a kook. Your grandpa was a kook. For some reason, when you say that you want to quit, we don't just accept that and say see ya for some reason. But once again, his attempts to, you know, explore all the stuff about Atlantis and, like, learn about the Shepherd's Journal and find it and blah, 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 it's all thwarted. But he goes home and basically gets, you know, kind of kidnapped by a lady. And he meets Whitmore, who is an eccentric billionaire type kind of person who knew his grandfather, who was a great explorer. And he actually has proof that the stuff that his grandfather was talking about with Atlantis is real. And he has the Shepherd's Journal, and he sends Milo on an exhibition to actually go to Atlantis and go to these ruins and blah, 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 using the same team that they used to get said Shepherd's Journal. So the team is all gathered. You learn about all the characters, blah, blah, blah. Milo's the odd man out because he's the goofy nerd and he keeps causing trouble. A lot of people die. Doesn't matter because it turns out they're all bad. They make it to Atlantis. You get to have your lovely, nice colonizer versus mean colonizer conflict, I guess. The city becomes in danger because the head of the exhibition crew, a military white man, is clearly evil and just wants money. And they discover that the city has people and a power source that basically runs their whole existence. And so they, you know, he wants to steal it and blah, blah, blah. So there's conflict there. And meanwhile, you have Kida, the princess, who is called the same power source, just like her mom. And we gotta save the day. But first, we gotta have Milo save her, because you still gotta have the man doing stuff. So yeah, that's it. You know, it's Atlantis, you know. I keep wanting to say Atlanta, and it's really hard.
The lost city of Atlanta.
Like a weird combination where, like, all of a sudden, like, Donald Glover's there trying to help Kida with her rap career, and it's just like, yeah.
Yeah, so the best thing I can say about this movie is that I think that it does... Atlantis does look good. I like the design work. And not just Atlantis. I think a lot of the design work on over this film looks good. I think the character designs look good. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we are quickly approaching the last hurrah for Disney animation, this hand-drawn animation before it's gotten rid of forever. And I think this movie does a pretty good job. And actually, this movie has the most CG of any hand-drawn animated film Disney has ever done. And at the time, there are a lot of people who are criticizing it to hell for that. And I saw one interesting review of this film that said that traditional animation fans will scoff at this. Huh. This is definitely not what people are going to want. People do not want CG films. They want hand-drawn animation films. He said that in the same year, I believe, that Shrek comes out. I don't know what that guy's doing right now, but I suspect he's homeless. but yeah, I do just really like the way this movie... I think this movie is a better-looking movie than Emperor's New Groove. And that might be because I'm just so used to Emperor's New Groove at this point, because I've seen it so many times. But I just think it's a very pretty movie without being... And I think it's better than Tarzan, because I think Tarzan spent way too much time trying to make Tarzan skateboard through vines, and it was bothersome.
I was just going to agree that, like, I think that the incorporation, like, I think the CG is well incorporated into the animation. Like, I think it is an enhancement and not something that, like, I don't think the two animation styles are, like, battling each other at all. I think it overall, like, makes it just look more interesting.
Yeah, and it's aged great.
Yeah, like I think it still looks good.
A lot of times you'll see CG added to hand-drawn animation from this era and a little before it, and it just looks like shit, like, years later. It probably looked like shit at the time a little bit, but definitely within a few years it looks bad. Looks good now. Like, this is 21 years after the fact. This movie still looks really good. That's a testament. This is a shame that this movie... did as bad as it did, because if this had been the direction that Disney animation would go through, I think that we could have gotten a lot of interesting stuff. Like, I think that if Disney hadn't decided to just go full CG and just had kind of like this really seamless hybrid, like in this film, I think that I would be a little happier in my life.
It's always so frustrating, because in a similar way with practical effects, you always wonder, like, what could have been, like, if advancement could have continued in this way, and you would have had a continuation of the balancing of hand-drawn animation and CG in conjunction with each other. Like, what would it look like if you kept, like, playing around with that and making more advancements? And we will probably never get that kind of thing, really, and it's a little bit of a bummer.
The other things I liked about this, I'm jumping a little ahead, and I'll probably revisit some of this when we get to characters, but I like the vast majority of the performances from the secondary characters. Not that I don't like Michael J. Fox, but I think the secondary characters' performances are very good. There's some standouts. I do want to name drop Leonard Nimoy as being very full of gravitas in this.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, because I had forgotten, you know, that he was in this. And I definitely, like, as soon as he started speaking, I'm like, is that Leonard Nimoy? Let me take a look at IMDb. Yeah, it's Leonard Nimoy!
Yeah.
Oh, like, so we have at least two Transformers actors in this. So that's exciting.
Oh, you're talking about Corey Burton.
Yeah.
As well. Yeah. Yeah, I don't like Corey Burton in this film that much, but that's fine. That's fine.
I want to talk about this more when we get to characters, but yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I would love to say that I loved the characters in this. I really would like to say, because I think the performances are good, and I think that there's like a hint of some really interesting casts here.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, this kind of leads me to what I have to say next, and I don't have anything else good to say about this movie. Unfortunately, we kind of reached the end of it in there. And just so I can segue properly, one of the problems, not the biggest problem, but one of the problems here is just how goddamn like hollow the whole cast feels outside of Milo.
Yeah.
Oh my God. To get the backstory of all of the main characters that Milo hangs out with ends up being one after the other of them briefly giving exposition about their background. And the movie's like, this is fine.
And also, what shitty writing to do it that way. It's like, all right, let's just kind of go around the circle. Everyone take a turn saying two sentences about what got them here. Let's take 5 minutes to give you an inner life. Like, it's just like, yeah, very lame.
No, it's very frustrating. And the fact that they spend so little time developing these characters, you give zero shits when it turns out that every single person on this expedition except for Milo was secretly evil. And then you give even less shits when the core characters that were hanging out with Milo betray the evil guys to side with Milo, because it's like, I don't know any of you well enough to understand if this is out of character or not.
Yeah, it all happens so fast, too, because it's just like, they go from being like, yeah, I guess fuck these people, and then all of a sudden...
Sorry, I'm remembering, like, they blow up a wall, and then there's, like, the main cast, minus Milo, have burst through the walls of the Atlanteans, and, like, you know, sorry, I don't have all their names down, so give me a quick second. Yeah, so Vinny, you know, he's, like, you know, got the dynamite, like, hey, knock, knock, and then you see Mole with the most sinister-looking grin sitting next to him. He's like, we are here to fuck up your day. We are here to rob and kill all of you. That is the aura that these characters are giving off. And then 5 minutes later, they're like, hey, you know, maybe we should, hang out with this Milo kid after all.
Yeah, it makes no sense. Audrey turning around and changing her mind with that, I could see that happening because, like, she's, like, still, like, young and impressionable. And I could see her being, maybe not the killing. When Vinny is the next person to be like, you know, I'm not doing that. It felt so hollow. Like, I could not feel a single reason why he would turn around and be like, no, actually, I'm going to stay here. Like, it just, yeah.
Also, it's just did you notice that Dr. Sweet was not in that sequence because he was apparently treating the king at the time? So,
yeah, it seemed like
he was not getting in the car. So it sounds like he'd already made a choice. And that movie decided to not share this with us.
Well, I think you were supposed to assume that, like, him going to the king and being like, this wasn't part of the plan, was, I guess, technically that moment for him.
Okay, look, that's all well and good, but apparently he made the decision that he was going to be a doctor and sacrifice ever leaving this area and dying with the native people. And we're supposed to get all that, kind of moment from, for that from that one sequence. It's like, hey, that wasn't part of the deal. Like, no, that's awful. Now, this brings me to my other point. Still not the worst part of this movie.
Yeah.
But this movie is fucking short. It is way too short for this type of film.
I was a little surprised. Like, the final fight ends so quickly. Like, the situation with Rourke, when he turns into, like, the scary blue creature, that part happens for, like, 2 seconds. Basically, Rourke basically kidnaps power source-infused Kida and has her in this metal container, and like they're trying to get away, and they're up on this, you know, like Zeppelin kind of thing. And while Milo is trying to rescue her, the like kind of glass of the container that she's in like gets smashed and has like glass that has like the essence of that power source on it. And Milo cuts Rourke, and somehow that junk gets into him. And for a second, he seems like this kind of mindless creature. And in my mind, like in the memory of this, I thought there was going to be more to that. Like more of him like trying to get away from this like monster man. But like, it's like only 2 seconds. Like he starts to be frozen and then he's like not frozen. But then he like just kind of like goes into the little helicopter, little propellers and gets destroyed real quick. And it's just like, God, yeah, there's a lot of like moments that I thought were like longer that happen very fast.
Yeah. They also don't really explain exactly what happened to him either.
That's another thing. Because it's like, because it's all like so fast, and it's just like, what even was this?
like it's the power. Because it's not like he doesn't even cut him with the power source. He cuts him with glass.
Yeah, the glass that has exposed
to it, right?
Yeah, and it's like, what the fuck is that?
Does it just turn humans into diamond monsters? Like, I don't get it. But like, so 100. This script was originally 155 pages. Typical Disney script is 90 pages. Now, let's say that with scripts, roughly, it's 1 minute to go through one page of a script. This is not always true. This doesn't always work out, but on a rough scale, this is how you typically can kind of guess. This movie ends up being about 90 minutes. So if we use that logic, that 1 minute per page, that means that roughly 75 minutes of content were left on the cutting room floor when they were trimming this down. 75 minutes. Now, let's say that that's too much, right? But even a half hour of that could have been used to develop so much stuff. We get so little development for most of these characters. I mean, hell, there's not even a let's get the band together type of scene where we like get to know the characters as they're recruited. They're already there. They already know each other. Milo's the outsider. So because we're also the outsider, it's weird because there's not really a lot of like urgency for them to introduce themselves to this guy who they don't even like initially.
I'm also like a little confused of like the timeline with that. Like,
oh God, the timing so confusing. Cause like by the way, it's like, okay, so it's 1914, right? So like, so that's where our start date is for this film. But like, Milo's grandfather is dead. We are never told how long he's been dead.
Yeah.
It's just, he says his grandfather, he doesn't seem to be in like deep mourning, right? So it doesn't feel like it happened recently. However, apparently, the crew that was assembled to find Atlantis had been assembled to find the Shepherd's Journal, which apparently Milo's grandfather was a part of that team. They all knew him except for Audrey. Although that implies that Audrey hasn't been there very long, and yet Rourke is like, oh, you're picking now to change sides? And like, wait, isn't she new too? Like,
yeah, because she was like taking over for her dad or whatever.
Yeah, so at some point, it had to be recently, Milo's grandfather had to have been alive to be with his team to go to Iceland to find the Shepherd's Journal. But then somewhere between him finding it and making out with the other old guy, he died.
And like, didn't include Milo.
Yeah, he did not bring Milo into any of this.
Like, it doesn't, because like the timing of this makes it seem like this must have been relatively recently.
Yeah, and Milo is young, but the implication that we get from what we see of his life does imply that he's probably been in his situation for a while. So he's been a academic expert probably for a couple years at this point.
Yeah, like at the very least, like I can't. He must be like, what, low mid 20s? Like, and considering the time frame that must have happened for this expedition, at the worst, Milo must have been like college age. Still, I mean, It's like backpacking through Europe age. He could have gone. Like it just doesn't make sense. Like had he only said that, like, the grandpa had, Thaddeus Thatch had this plan before he died, but then he died, and so I decided to get this team together to find the Shepherd's Journal like he wanted, and I found it. Like, that would have made more sense. I don't know why they had to write it that he had gone with them and been a part of this.
Also, I'm surprised that they didn't reveal that Rourke killed Miles' grandpa. Like, I thought that was going to be the big reveal near the end. And it was like, oh, you're soft, just like your grandpa was soft. I'll take care of you the way I took care of him.
And then, oh my God, that didn't even occur to me. That would have been some stakes.
Yeah, that would have been a bit more interesting if, like, especially if that happened, like, you know, when he first abandons him in Atlantis, and then he has to be like, oh, he killed my grandpa. Mm. Of course, then the rest of the team would have to be like, oh yeah, yeah, we knew about that, but you know, we didn't know how to bring it up because you know, with murder and all. That could have been a little awkward.
Oh man!
Like, did you guys know about this? Ah, oh, no, 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 no. Yeah, we did. Yeah, we were there. Yeah. I
think you're also establishing that Vinny is the most fun.
Yeah. Oh, I'll explain why. We get to characters, but yes, you picked it up. You picked up my opinion very accurately. Yeah, it's very weird, but like, a lot of this stuff probably could have explored more if we had more time. Like, a movie like this should probably be at least 2 hours. Honestly, it's probably be 2.5 hours, but I can understand why making an animated film that might be geared more towards kids, you might not want to have it be that long. But 90 minutes is definitely not enough. And so much stuff suffers. The plot suffers. The characters really suffer. You don't get, it's hard to get attached to anybody. And things just go so fast. It's literally splat. Like, it's just so crazy fast how things move. And we do not get to explore Atlantis in the extent that one would think you'd get to.
And that you fucking need. Because...
Oh, my God.
Lord, oh my God. Fucking what?
Two Atlanteans have any lines of any important of the however many thousands or hundreds of, I don't know how many people are there, but of all of the people of this indigenous place, only two of them have any real lines. And it is nuts. The protagonist outside of Milo interact with none of them. It's just Milo talking to Kida, and it is it. That is crazy.
What is a civilization? Are we there yet? Can we get into it?
We just say one thing, then we can. I'm just saying that what they should have been there more than just one night.
Yes.
They should have been like at least a couple of days.
Yep.
But I think they said one night because we got to get this movie going. It's a tight 90. Okay. Yes. Now we can talk about the civilization of Atlantis.
What the fuck? There's a lot of things happening here. There is, once again, a crew of white men writing and directing this story about indigenous peoples.
With the main difference being that these indigenous people are made up.
Yeah, so they get to incorporate their awful skewed opinions into things and just like force them upon this made up indigenous society. And it's awful. It is awful. The way they present Atlantis, They posit that this society that has been here for billions of years, and these people, for thousands of years, and these people themselves, individual people, have been here for thousands of years. Because, like, it doesn't seem like Kida's situation is that, like, oh, well, she and her dad happen to be thousands of years old. It seems like it's such a matter-of-fact thing that it seems to be all of them. And for some reason, they have lost their culture. They don't know how to read anymore for reasons unfucking known. Like, it doesn't make any sense why they don't know how to use their technology anymore. And it's all the same fucking people.
Yeah.
Like, and this is a civilization that you could easily, like, where are your scholars? Where are the people, like, telling your stories and blah, blah, blah? Like, there's no reason for you to have just, like, forgotten how to fucking read. And, like, it's one of those things, like, I'm watching this and, like, I'm sure, like, these, you know, these white men are trying to say something. And it's just like, do you think, like, say, in America, that, like, indigenous culture, like, indigenous peoples, like, lost their culture because they just fucking forgot about it? Like, you lose your people's culture when, like, fucking colonizers come in and destroy your way of life and slash your culture out of your souls. Like, that's what happens. That's what happened in America. Do you think that these people just forget their shit and they're like, you know, I forgot how to read my language and we just cannot get it back? Can you, white guy who has been studying our culture, can you tell us about our culture? Because we done forgot. Thanks, white man.
There's a couple ways this could have gone, but the easiest way to fix a lot of this would just be to not have them be so old. Like if Kida was, like, you know, 20 as opposed to 9,000 years old, you can say that, like, the destruction of Atlantis caused them to lose a lot of stuff. And, like, you could have said that, but, like, no, these are the same people. These are the same people that we saw earlier. So but in, like, order to
even,
make this...
Like, even then, you have, like, oh, no, I'm
not
other...
Saying, not saying this would fix it, just saying it would make it better.
Oh, sure. Because, like... Yes, over generations, you could lose some things. Sure.
Well, I mean, like, it was a catastrophic, apocalyptic situation for them. Like, their whole continent sunk into the sea. Who knows how much of their stuff survived? I will say that. If they had been many, many generations after the apocalypse, then I can see them losing some of that stuff. That does not explain why there's a manual with all the information that they would need that's only a couple hundred years old, floating around in Iceland. I don't quite know how that explains that. But for some reason, they insisted on making these people, like, thousands of years old individually, which I thought was a weird choice. But there are things they could have said that could have made sense. Because even though she's 9,000 years old, she was a little baby when she... Or a little toddler or whatever, when Atlantis fell. So who knows how long it takes her to actually grow up. Perhaps there could have been, like, a plot point that the king of Atlantis was like, because he says, and they don't go into it very much because this is a tight 90, we gotta keep moving, but he does imply that the reason that Atlantis sank was he tried to harness the power of their crystal to be weaponized. Mm-hmm. And then he ended up destroying their whole continent. It could have been said that he was so ashamed and of what he had done and of what that power could do in the wrong hands, that he purposely purged a lot of the knowledge so that no one could do it again. And at this point, all the people who were adults at the time are either so old that they are unimportant, or they're like him, or they've already died. Like, he seems like he's at death's door already. So this, you could have said that, and that could have helped the blow, but this is a tight 90 and you can't actually have any reasoning for it. You just have to have an excuse for Mighty Whitey to come in and be able to be the person who can save the day.
God, like, that had occurred to me that could be, like, the reasoning partially behind this. But even that is just, like, because they only present only those two characters as even being, like, cognitive humans that do anything. If you said the rest of the people in the city were just, like, fucking Westworld robots, I could believe you, because what the fuck do we know? We're not sure if they actually speak. But, like, assuming that this is a full functioning society that has offices, positions in different parts to make a civilization run like any other civilization, it would have to be a full-on dictator state, like authoritarian state, that he would have to actively repress the functioning and culture of his own society. He would have to say, no one reads anymore, you know? And even if you'd change the scenario that, you know, people did not live thousands of years and these are different generations, like, even in the times of, like, the most distress, like, they still have their city. And after the initial, like, you still always have, like, different sects of your civilization. Even in times of war, you still have, like, arts and culture to some degree still happening. And the idea that, like, everything would be lost so dramatically would suggest that there was, like, nothing ever done to preserve it, when it's just like, you don't have any other outside influences. What the fuck else do you have to do? Like, it just, like,
I mean, they say they don't have outside influence. I maintain that if they speak French, self-examine.
That shit doesn't make sense. I appreciate the attempt to try to make it, to try to give a reason why these people can all of a sudden speak English to the English speakers who come. Everyone likes to play the game about, like, you know, do we need to have a reason for this, or do we just going to have them speak English? And their solution was like, I don't know, it's a base dialect of apparently of this a mother dialect of all these other languages that spurred out, so they could just speak anything. That makes no sense. But
you know, see, the original version of the script, there was a talking tree who gave them the colors of the wind that allowed them to speak all different languages. But that part got cut out. It was it felt a little cheesy, a little corny. A movie that does that would be probably not that good.
Yeah, like, all I get, just like, I'm just like watching this and I'm just like, where's this king's fucking advisor? Like, who else is here? Like, who else is running this shit? What is happening? It is crazy. Like, do you have teachers? Like, what is... And also, I am confused about, like, when, you know, they say that their way of life is dying and stuff like that, and everything seems to be, like, falling apart and crumbling. I'm confused, like, in what way is that happening? And how is that fixed? Like,
that would make a lot more sense if they all weren't immortal.
Yeah, like, I'm confused. Because I feel like the biggest problem, I would think, would be, like, overpopulation, which doesn't seem to be an issue. Because, like, you see that there's, like, a, you know, a background character, like, standing with a baby in her arms. So it's like, y'all are close to immortal, and you're still obviously procreating. I feel like that would be an issue, considering that you have a little wee island. But that doesn't seem to be the discussion. And why is everything in ruins? Why? You're, like, surrounded by, like, outside of the city. You're surrounded by, like, all of this, like, broken infrastructure that you could use to keep and maintain your city. What is everyone doing?
Also, where did the sea monster come from, if not from
them?
Who
made the sea monster? Yeah, like...
Because, like, why would Atlantis, a above-ground empire on its own continent, need to build a sea monster? So one would think that the Atlanteans post-apocalypse would have built that, right, for protection. But they can't build anything. They don't know technology. So where did that thing come from?
They themselves never mention it. No one goes, oh, I see you got past the Leviathan. Like, they never mention it.
Wow, they really should have just made that thing not a robot, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, they talk about them being so technologically advanced, and then
Milo explicitly says that they are far more advanced than we are now.
But they still go out of their way to present them as primitive brown people.
Because if they didn't, then there'd be no way that the evil white people could impose their colonialism on them. Because they wanted to tell that story, and they needed the white men to be technologically superior. Otherwise, you come like, they come like, knock, knock, and they're like, and then the Atlanteans would say, who's there? And then shoot them with their plasma rifles and then eliminate them all.
Like, why don't y'all know how to use your flying car things? Why can't you use your air fish bikes? That doesn't make any sense.
I mean, like, I guess they didn't know how to use, like, she was embarrassingly close to figuring it out.
And, like,
It's like the equivalent of forgetting to hit to put your foot on the brake when you're pushing the go button in the modern car. I can't get the story. I don't know how.
Because, like, even technologically, if you go, or, like, even, like, culturally, if, like, things like, I don't know, reading is, like, suppressed, so, like, people forget to read and shit. Like, why would no one remember how to use these vehicles? When would you have stopped? I don't think they would have just, like, suddenly stopped using them once they were underwater. Like, it just doesn't make sense.
When I was watching this, when he was saying, like, oh, they're more technologically advanced than us. And I don't remember the plot details of this. It's been so long. And I'm thinking, like, oh, man, that's interesting. They're going to be, like, running circles around these guys coming in. And nope, it's Pocahontas again. This movie is Pocahontas if Pocahontas was called John Smith and only Pocahontas and her father ever talked amongst the tribe.
Like, they 100%, like, take away these people's agency and the way they tell this story. Because they basically go, like, no, they don't actually, like, achieve stuff. They just have a magic ball that, you know, makes them immortal. And even when it comes to Kida, you don't even, like, allow her to properly save the day. Because when she gets possessed by the crystal, she's not her. Like, it's all about the kings of our past. And I think this is another, I think gender is weird in this movie as well, for sure. And, like, it's all about saving her, like, the main guy saving her. And even when it's supposed to be her saving the city, it's all about the kings of the past working through her. And she is just a puppet who does these things. And in the end, it's all about honoring her dad. That is the reason why you've had so much destruction, and no honoring her mom or her, the people who actually technically saved the city. Like, where is the memorial to her goddamn mom who saved them all? Like, it's crazy.
Kind of going back a little bit from what you kind of mentioned about them being robbed of agency. Because all the stuff that they have was basically gifted to them by a magic ball, right? Yeah. This reminds me of the big problem with the ancient alien theories.
Yes, exactly. 100. Like, that was the same parallel that I was thinking. Go on.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like the idea that these ancient structures that exist in non-European countries that are very famous, the idea is that they were actually constructed or at least guided by aliens coming to Earth. But the implication is that those indigenous people who built those were not sophisticated enough or intelligent enough or resourceful enough to do that on their own. There must have been some sort of outside influence in order to make sure that they could, like the pyramids. The pyramids mm-hmm. are too sophisticated for the Egyptians to come up on their own. It had to have been aliens. And it's an unfortunate thing. Like, those ancient alien guys, they don't really, like, when they're asked about that, they're kind of going like, oh no, you're the racist one.
I'm such white bag gaslight. Oh no, you're racist for asking me about
racism. Some of my best friends are ancient Egyptians.
Some of my best friends are aliens. So
no, so it's definitely kind of lousy. But you know what? I will say this. They're not developed enough for us to actually know one way or the other because they don't take any time to fucking develop the title people in this movie.
There is another very frustrating white person moment that really grind my gears.
Well, I wonder I wonder if it's the same thing I was thinking. Go ahead.
I probably. I feel like you know what tends to get me upset. So, like, there's a scene where Milo and Kida, they're, like, kind of climbing through the city. Once again, we have the whole, like, animalistic brown woman kind of, like, crawling through, like, the jungle and shit for no fucking reason. But he asks her name. She says her name is Kirakakash. And he immediately goes, it doesn't even try to really pronounce her name. He's like, Karagashnaga. Do you have a nickname? Motherfucking white man, learn her goddamn name and don't just go like, well, your name is foreign and weird. I'm not doing that. You got a nickname, brown chick? I was so mad that they made that into a joke because many people of different ethnicities have had to have this thing where like your like white boss is like introducing themselves to you and you say your name that might not be a familiar thing to him and it's like, do you have a nickname? Like, fuck you, Milo. I don't know why she likes you.
In defense of that aspect, they don't actually show them like doing any kissing. I mean, they clearly do get together, but there's not a whole lot of romance going on between them.
Hands.
Yeah. Yes, this was the thing I thought you'd be upset about, because I was upset about it. I take it a little even farther than this, because I thought, because what bothered me the most about it wasn't just that he did that, but like, he's a fucking linguist.
Yeah.
He should be the one white guy who would at least make an effort to, and he spent how much of his adult life studying this language? He probably should know how to pronounce it, but yeah, they decided to go for the joke, even though it doesn't actually make sense for his character. It makes it even worse.
Yeah, they had to go for the racist joke. Like, even they had to force a racist joke onto a character who shouldn't even have the joke. Like, that is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, like, best case scenario, or I guess the worst case scenario, he should have repeatedly pronounced it incorrectly, but like not stupid the way he does it there, and she keeps having to correct him. And maybe she's like, okay, look, your accent is bad, just call me Kita.
Yeah,
I would have accepted that a lot more.
Yeah, if the conversation of like, how's my accent on it, and that was like, it's boorish and provincial and blah blah blah, you can just call me Kita, I would accept that more than this shit.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else we need to like complain about this movie before we get at the characters? I feel like we've kind of ripped this thing a new one.
I've been sitting on it for days. Oh God. I'm sure if something else comes up, I'll mention it. I think some things might come up just as we're naturally talking about characters, but like, I just, fucking white man, I just fucking can't.
Okay.
Exhausted. All right, okay, just related to this. And in the end, they still got to take a bunch of, like, treasures from these people. But in this scenario, because it's the white man writing a story about a fake civilization, they just happily give them their, like, prize possessions and have them go about their way. Like, it's just, all right, let's keep going.
At least in Road to El Dorado, there was so much gold that they legitimately didn't seem to give a shit about it.
Yeah, it was like, my toothbrush is gold, I'm not worried about it. But like, yeah, and this is just like, I just hate when it just comes back to that. It's like, but hey, and like, we all get to like make a bunch of money off of these people, have a good time, I'm about to, you know, like, it's bad. I don't like it.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently the sequel kind of has a bit more lasting consequences to its ending as far as Atlantis to the rest of the world. But I don't want to watch that, so
I know, like, I watched this on Disney Plus, and at the end of the credits, you know, it goes like, basically changed to a screen, it's like, go watch the next movie. I don't think I could ever bring myself to watch that.
Yeah. All right, let's talk characters. So I mentioned before that most of the characters are flat because the movie does not take any time to really develop them. Unfortunately, there's a lot of big name people who I kind of want to talk about. So I was hoping this section would be kind of short, but I think it might end up not being as short as I wanted to be. But I will try to go through this as quickly as possible. But I do want to mention Milo being played by Michael J. Fox in a kind of a rare voice actor role. Like, he's not an actor who does a ton of voice acting roles. He does it occasionally. This is before Stuart Little.
Oh, right. Sure. His voice is so obviously him. Like, it really is just like, if you're gonna use Michael J. Fox, it's because you want Michael J. Fox's voice. Like, I kept waiting for him to yell something about the DeLorean. Like, I just kept waiting for it.
Or call Sweet Doc.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh. You know, there must have been some takes. It was like, could you, you know what? I don't think we could have you call him Doc.
Interestingly, Fox was actually offered the lead role. Well, okay, he was offered a role for Titan A.E. I assume it's the lead that ultimately went to Matt Damon. I think it's Matt Damon who's in that. If I'm wrong, I apologize. But apparently he let his son choose which movie he would work on. And his son had him choose Atlantis, which I think is technically the better choice because Titan A.E. was a big old bomb, 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 bomb. While this was more of a disappointment.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about Milo. Like he's like, I'm not sure how much there is to say. Like, he's kind of an okay lead, but like, I do feel that the film focused so much on him and not the other characters that it kind of becomes a little troubling. Like, there's a lot of weird aspects to him that kind of don't make any sense. Like, I don't, like you mentioned before, I don't really understand his role at the Smithsonian. Mm-hmm. Like, he does appear to actually be hired as an academic, because when he tries to quit or resign, he's told, are you going to throw your career away? Which wouldn't matter if he was just the janitor, you know, if he was just the boiler room maintenance guy.
And it's really weird because it's like, if you have him basically in the dungeon of your museum, how much do you really care if he quits? What does he do? Like, it's very confusing.
I don't know. Like, it's weird. But my big problem with Milo is that the idea of like the one person who can save this culture is this, like, you know, white, this mighty whitey, the only one who could speak the language. He's the only one who can come up with how to use technology, even though the only reason that Keita couldn't figure it out is that she moved her hand when she shouldn't have.
There's this scene right before the king dies, when he's, you know, he's basically confessed the reason why they're underwater in the first place is because of him. And he says, like, this burden should have gone on to Keita. Like, my burden should have gone on to Keita when she was ready. But now it goes to you. To Milo.
Room full of Atlanteans.
Like, once again, who the fuck else? Like, what is their culture structure? Who else is like running this shit? It is so crazy, and like it has to go to Milo. It has to go for the white man who's been here for 4 hours.
All right, so let's talk about Keita. Keita performance, Cree Summer does a really good job here. Everyone in this cast does a really good job. I think Michael J. Fox is just kind of Michael J. Fox. I think everyone else is doing really well. But Cree Summer, not a whole lot of leading roles to her credits, and technically this is one of them where she doesn't have a leading role, but I do really like what she does here with what she has, which is not a lot. I don't know. Have we talked about Cree Summer in any big capacity before on this podcast?
I don't think so. It's actually kind of weird because she's in a lot of stuff. That we have consumed.
If there was a cartoon with a black girl in it, she was probably playing that black girl.
Yeah. I mean, like,
Susie from Rugrats.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I love Cree Summer. Like, I obviously loved Susie. I have, like light purple leggings, and they're just, like, I'm just waiting to a day I can, like, acquire some red shoes and, like, a yellow shirt so I can, like, do this stuff properly. But, like, she's been in so many, like, and it's kind of funny because, like, her voice isn't too varied in any given thing. Like, she's not like a Phil Lamar where you're just like, well, fuck, I had no idea that shit was you. But, like, but still, she has, like, even though she kind of has a pretty signature sound, it's still, like, within that has a lot of interesting variation. And, like, hell, I love her in live action. I loved Freddy in A Different World, and I loved the growth of her character in that show.
Like, when she becomes a heartless lawyer?
I mean, like, there's a lot of things that go on. Like, she goes on from, like, this goofy character to, like, an activist hippie thing. Like, it's a lot of things that happen. I like it. And if you watch What We Do in the Shadows, she was in an episode of season three. Yeah. I was like, for a second, I forgot how many seasons are out. And I was just like, when I saw that, I was like, oh, shit, it's Cree Summer. I was really excited.
I only recognize her because of her voice.
I remember watching an episode of the new DuckTales, and she was a voice in that, and immediately was like, ah, it's Cree Summer.
Yeah. Kida, as a character, I feel is hindered by the same thing that hinders everybody else. Doesn't get nearly enough screen time to matter. And then she spends the last act being the combination of both Damsel in Distress and MacGuffin. So
yeah, like she's just a walking plot device.
Yeah, so she's just, you know, not super relevant, and you know, she has way too many of the tropes that we complained about in, like, you know, Pocahontas and Hunchback. And since it's the same team that did Hunchback, I guess we shouldn't have been surprised that they were, like, you know, since I think that these Disney animation teams spend a little too much time trying to make these, you know, sexy brown girl, you know.
Oh, sweet God. You gotta keep this stuff to your Pornhub, guys. You, like, stop.
Pornhub hadn't been invented yet. That's the problem. No Pornhub. We gotta do it in animation.
Fuck it. We have to do it in the cartoon.
No choice. We have to.
And there's another thing with the character design, that this is like a part of a larger thing that tends to happen in animation, at least did a lot more before I think more people called it out. But like this kind of like design where like a dark skinned woman is like special or magic and therefore has like flowing white hair and blue eyes. Like, the biggest thing that comes to mind for people is probably Storm. But, like, there are, like, actually, multiple scenarios of this in cartoons where you have these dark women or black women who are, you can tell that she's special. Her eyes are blue and her hair is flowing white and kind of adds to, like, the undercurrent of racism that has happened in cartoons. And it's just, like, it's just annoying. It's like, of course she's special. Her eyes are blue.
Yeah, Kida suffers from those lost 75 pages. Anyway, James Garner plays Rourke, who's the leader of the expedition. James Garner is a pretty interesting choice. Did a lot of action films, a lot of Western films. He does seem to be that type of actor who you might see in a live action version of this in, like, in the 50s.
Yeah.
He's good, but the character isn't developed enough for me to give two shits about his betrayal in the third act.
So, you know he's unhinged because his hair gets all ruffly.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. He does go nut bar crazy at the very end though. Like, he just is like his whole contraption that he's using to get to the surface is falling apart. It doesn't look he's going to win. He just starts being like, I'm just gonna kill you, and he's got this giant sadistic grin, and it's like, okay, hold on now, buddy.
He turns bedhead evil.
Also, why did he punch? Why did he punch Milo at that one part where he was like, "Oh, what have I forgotten to do?" Oh yes, and then he socks Milo in the jaw before abandoning him in Atlantis. Like, why?
I know why. Because the whole expedition, he's been like, nerd.
Yeah. He's an alpha beta. Ugh.
Yeah, 100%.
All right. And then like Claudia Christian. Who I guess he's mostly famous for being on Babylon 5, which I don't remember. But she plays Helga, who is Rourke's right-hand man. I'm very confused by this character. Especially since she's the one that recruits Milo, and she's tall, and she's got this femme fatale thing going on, but then she's like a soldier, but then like, how is she even a soldier in 1914? That doesn't make any sense. And then like, she's, again, not developed enough for me to care. Since her main thing is that she's sexy and evil.
Yeah, I find that very frustrating. Because they went out of their way in the like in her introduction to make her very oddly super sexy. Like once again, it's like this is a kid's like you don't need to. It's weird, and it's like you made her sexy, but also very capable. And I almost feel like having that combination, like it's like therefore she must be punished. You know, like I feel like they created this character, and there's this like now we shall make her evil and destroy her. And it's just like. It's like, what, you could have had, if you're going to make her this sexy yet capable person, could you not kill her? Like,
yeah.
Could you not? Could you fucking not? But it feels very, like, oh, she must, there must be something evil about her.
Very easy for her not to die, too.
Yeah. You couldn't have, not a heel turn. Do you call it a face turn? I don't know.
Yeah, they call it a face turn.
It's like, you couldn't have her do a face turn, too? Like, you, but like, no, she's... a sexy, capable woman. So, like, we gotta mix that. We gotta kill her.
Yeah. All right. So, the rest of the cast, who I want to touch on, I'm gonna try to go through really fast because I really don't want us to. I want us to wrap this up fairly soon. All right. So, Phil Morris plays Dr. Sweet. I like him a lot. I think the character's got a lot of interesting quirks and his background's interesting, but not developed enough for me to care about him. That's too bad because his Morris's delivery is great.
Yes, I think one interesting sweet the character is half black half Arapaho and has what seems to be a very interesting journey to get him to where he is now, which is like I kind of wish I knew that story. But yeah, like,
again, 1914. This is not the best time for him.
Yeah, in all ways possible, really. Like, when they're talking about, when they're going through character exposition, and Milo asks about Mole's story, and he's like, oh, you don't want to know. They told me, and I shouldn't have asked, and you don't want to know. Like, that
oh, whole, yeah, when he was like, yeah, he was asking, that was an amazing sequence.
Yeah, it was great. Great delivery. He has a great rhythm to his lines, and like it's very fun. He's a great voice actor in this.
Trust me, you don't want to know. You told me you shouldn't have. Now I'm telling you, you don't want to know.
it's very good.
Yeah, that was great. All right, I'm gonna butcher this person's name. I'm not. I don't feel good about it. Jacqueline Obradors. Sorry about that. This does not sound good. Does not feel good. But she plays Audrey. The mechanic, again, great delivery, interesting character. She is not developed enough for us to care, but it sucks a little bit more with her because her character actually makes the least amount of sense of everyone outside of Milo on the crew. Because again, how long has she been there? She has to be, if not the, like, she has to be like the newest person outside of Milo. Like, she should know the rest of the crew. Maybe not as well as they all know each other. Maybe you could say she grew up on her days. But then again, how long has this team been together? Her dad retired when she was put this team. Like, wait, how? Oh God, so many questions. Okay,
yeah, it falls apart very fast.
It's cute to have a teenager doing this in this role as a mechanic, but they don't do a good job of explaining it. Again, would have been better if it was more. If it was more time to develop the character. Blah.
Yeah, it's like frustrating because I feel like I'm feeling essence of like, look at what we're doing. Look at all these like female characters we have, like women doing things. Just like, and it feels very like 2001.
Yeah. Florence Stanley, who is it safe to say legendary actress at this point?
So, like, Mrs. Packard, which she has fun one-liners, you know, it's whatever.
No, so I like her a lot in what we see of her. We don't see her enough, so we don't get to know her enough, so it's hard to care. But I really like how she's just on the phone. Like, the entire sequence, like, when they're on the submarine, and I really wish that they were on the sub way longer so she could have done that shtick longer. I like some of the stuff you hear her say. It's like... like, Margie, if he packs his bags, I don't think he's coming back.
It's so funny, because, like, this is happening in, like, complete chaos. Like that ship is going down. And you're also like, God, who is her provider? Because, like, She's getting a signal down there. It's so funny. And yeah,
it's like, it's 1914. So like, who has a fucking telephone?
It's amazing. And I love, like, and when they're trying to figure out like the sounds that they're hearing of the Leviathan, and they're kind of like invading her station, and she's like, okay, if you want to do it, be my guest. And you're like, you know, like 100%, like, she fully means that. Like, I would love to not do anything, so fucking go for it. Like, it's always fun to have an old lady who's just like chucking it in the fuck it bucket.
I also like when she's trying to get the commander's attention, and he's like conversating with Milo, and and she's just very calmly just going like, commander. And it goes on the perfect amount of time.
Yeah, like, this is a woman who's like, I am 100% not getting my heart rate up above 55.
Yeah, liked it. Too bad we didn't get more of her.
I will say that as soon as I heard her, I was like, Goofy movie. She's from the Goofy movie. I remember. And looked up. It's like, I was like, I can just hear her saying eggs. And it's like, yeah, she was the waitress in the Goofy movie. And I just, it's always just exciting when you're just like, I remember your little bit in that thing. So all right, keep going.
Yeah. Corey Burton is Mole. Corey Burton was in Transformers. He did a lot of roles in Transformers. My favorite role of his in Transformers is actually Shockwave. Mm. But he also did a ton of other people, including, I believe he was actually, let me double check this if I can. I believe.
He's in the Clone Wars and stuff. Like, the idea that this voice, Mole, is also Count Dooku and Cad Bane. What a range this guy has.
Yeah, no, he can do a lot of different voices. It was something I wanted to double check, because I think he did, but I wanted to know for sure. Yeah, he actually played Megatron in Transformers Animated, and he's a completely different type of Megatron. He also played Brainiac in the Superman cartoon and the Justice League cartoon.
Oh, I can't remember what that sounded like.
Robotic. he's the voice of Ludwig von Drake from the various Disney properties. Mm. Most recently, he did it in DuckTales. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Apparently, he did Dale from Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers.
Yes, I did hear about that, which I still haven't watched that movie.
I meant the original, but yes, he also does it in the new movie for a little bit as well. Very probably the Cree Summer does a lot of stuff. Corey Burton has done more.
To be perfectly frank. Which, I mean, justifiably so. I mean, he is a vocal chameleon. So, like, sure. It's not surprising that he has had, like, I think when I looked on his IMDb, his, like, acting credits were, like, over 400. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Okay. I skipped someone specifically. Mm-hmm. Who else did I... But is there anyone else that I accidentally skipped? Jim Varney is Cookie. He's, fine, but he's like I don't know, man. It's like, I think the character is kind of distracting. I didn't talk about Mole because I didn't want to talk about Mole when I was talking about Corey Burton. Let's talk about how great Corey Burton is. Mole sucks. I hate him. He's a weird character. He just seems to be weird for the sake of being weird. Although I do like that they explicitly don't tell us his backstory, and they say because you don't want to know, and they make a big deal about how you don't want to know. I do like that, but I don't like him. I also don't like Cookie for kind of similar things, although I do like the line where no one wants to eat the food. It's like, don't worry, it will keep and keep and keep.
I do think my favorite Cookie thing is like when they're leaving and Cookie gives Milo like his spare bacon grease, which... Don't scoff at that. You can cook a lot of things with some bacon grease. That's actually a pretty good thing to have. But, like, when he goes, like, oh, thanks, and, like, and Cookie can't even bring himself to say anything else. He's like, yeah. He has to, like, he's, like, trying to hide his tears, and he can't actually get any words out. Like, I loved that. But, like, yeah, in general, it's like...
The big thing about Cookie's presence here is that I believe this is Jim Varney's last performance. And I think did even...
wonder that.
Yeah, I think even as he was recording lines, I think he knew that he was not going to live to see this movie come out.
Honestly, the quality of his voice kind of sounds just weathered, you know?
I mean, it's good that he's playing an old man then.
Yeah, but like in a similar way, whereas it's like, I think back to like, or I think I said this at the, like years ago, but like you think about like the first two Harry Potter movies, and I'm forgetting the actor's name who played the Dumbledore at first, but like I remember thinking like his voice sounds so weak that like it sounds like he's about to die, and he did. And I remember when Michael Gambon came on before he, you know, completely broke my heart with his inability to play Dumbledore, but I was excited at the time because it's like, okay, you have like, his voice is strong, he sounds like he's healthy. And like I feel like Jim Varney in this, like, I don't know, it sounds like he is diminished.
Yeah. Okay. Our friend David Ogden Steers plays Harcourt, the Fenton H. Harcourt from the Smithsonian Institute, who rejects Milo's presentation. I only bring him up because he's barely in this. I only bring him up because this is basically the trilogy of Disney movies that this guy was in, because he was Ratcliffe in Pocahontas. He was a priest in Hunchback. And then now here he is as this guy who works in the Smithsonian. No, actually, you know what his title is. I just wanted to make sure I mentioned him because I mentioned in those previous movies that he was going to be in Atlantis. Now here we are talking about Atlantis. I want to make sure I mentioned him. Okay. And then John Mahoney, who's most famous for being the dad in Frasier, is playing the Whitmore-centric millionaire, blah, 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 guy who was friends with Milo's dad. What an interesting character that probably would have been a lot more interesting if we saw more of him, but we don't.
Yeah.
Wow, I feel like I've been saying that a lot. Okay. Now I want to talk about the real star of this movie, and that is... so I'm not sure if this is how this is pronounced. Is it the Don DeVoyo or is it Don DeVello?
I think if he is Italian, I would assume it's Novello.
Okay. Let's say Novello. He's a relatively famous comedic actor. Was on SNL at some point. Vinny is the best part of this movie, basically, as far as all the characters go. Now, he still is a character that is horribly under... written, could have had a lot more time. Don't give a shit that he turned on Milo like every other character, because they didn't put enough time to make me care about him. But he has the best lines in the film by a country mile, and the reason he has those best lines is because he kept improvising during recording. So what they ended up doing is that they would have him read the script, and then they would have him redo the scene with him saying whatever he wants, and they ended up keeping 100% of the improv. All his lines in this film were improv.
That is amazing, because it is a little weird contrast, because like he is so fun and it does really stick out in the movie, and like I had no idea that it's because it's him. Like God, these writers suck.
Yeah, he's easily the most likable of the explorers who are on the team. I would have loved to see just a lot more of this guy. Unlike everybody else, like he manages to optimize the time he has there. So I actually did kind of feel a little bad about him turning on Milo. I said I didn't, but I will say I did feel a little bad, because he just seems so heartless about blowing up that room, be like, knock, knock, like, oh, he's going to kill all those indigenous people.
Yeah.
Like, that's why you should have stayed in the Turkish prison.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's just like, their approach to being like, I guess it's cool to kill these people. It's like, because, I mean, okay, Helga does say, you know, like, didn't expect people to be there. This changes everything. And then Work is like, it changes nothing. Why everyone else seems to be like, I agree, it changes nothing. Is strange.
Yeah. If only this movie had an additional 70 minutes.
But his, oh God, like the nitroglycerin bit, where like he Milo drinks water and he's like, oh no, that was nitroglycerin and blah blah blah, and has this whole thing. Like I found that really like lovable. And then like later on they need to get through a wall and he's talking about like the amount of dynamite he has left, and it's like, we need like 10,000 of, and I only have like 10 plus 4 of my own, some cherry bombs, and too bad we don't have some nitroglycerin, eh, Milo? And it's just like, it's just so fun. And it's, I love it. It's like, I have 10 sticks of dynamite plus 4 of my own. Like, this is like personal dynamite. He doesn't want to waste that.
Freddy, did you know that Rourke killed my grandpa? No. I mean, okay, look, I the lesson learned is that you don't keep the nitroglycerin around for at least the drink. Look, I thought it was funny when I did it to you. It wasn't so funny with your grandpa.
Turns out your grandpa likes to burp, so here we are.
Okay, any other characters that we should talk about?
No. Oh, the king's bad. I mean, like...
Oh, yeah, the king. We've kind of talked about the king all through this.
Yeah, he has made bad decisions, and everyone's suffering for it. Yeah. But you don't
really... The first thing we said about here was that we liked Leonard Nimoy's performance. That's the first good thing I said.
Yeah, so, like, just to... Now that we're in this section, just to reiterate the things that we said before.
Yeah.
Fuck that king.
Yeah.
Give justice for the queen. She should get immortalized in the little, like, crystal circle, not the king.
Oh, you know what's gonna happen is that one day Kida and Milo are gonna be dead and they're gonna carve his head.
I 100% was thinking that. Like, oh, like if okay, I can't. I'm just gonna get all, I've gotten way too angry doing this episode.
Okay. Any other things you want to throw out before we wrap things up?
In my notes it just says, bitch, why can no one read? I don't have any other things. I think we've talked about... Oh, I don't know why this always... I don't know why this tickles me, but the line, the bug dumb bit me on my sit-upon, just makes me giggle. Don't know why.
I hated that line.
I don't know why it makes me giggle. It doesn't make any sense, but it does.
Someone's so gotta suck out the poison.
Not the next part. like that's the thing. Just the simple line, the bug done bit me on my sit upon. That line itself makes me giggle. I don't know why.
All right. So Ariel, let's wrap things up here. What would you give Atlantis, the Lost Empire? Would you give it a thumbs up, a thumbs down, or a thumb somewhere in the middle?
I think considering like the crazy level of anger that has brewed up inside me talking about this movie, it has to be a thumbs down. This movie like legit pisses me off.
Thumbs down from me as well. So I'm reminded of when I saw Aquaman, which is a better movie than this, I will say. Also a movie about Atlantis. But I don't think Aquaman was good, but it looked great. It was just, it looked fantastic when I saw it in theaters. It was a great time. I told my wife at the time that it was beautiful nonsense. And I think that term applies here as well. This movie, I can't believe that I liked a movie this poorly. Like I can't believe I disliked this movie so much, but thought it looked so good. Like I'm almost feel bad about giving it a thumbs down because of just how much I liked the look of it. But the fact is, this movie is bad for a bunch of reasons. It goes too fast. It's not enough development. It's pretty racist, even though it's not about real people, but they still make it racist. It is very upsetting. So it's beautiful to look at, but it's absolute nonsense. It is beautiful nonsense. That is now a genre of film.
I'll take it. No, I think right. that is a legit category of movie.
Yeah. I think that's going to do it for us this week. So next week, we are going to be looking at Lilo and Stitch. I say next week. I keep always saying next week. I have to remember to say next time because I never know when I'm going to get the next episode up. But next time, Lilo and Stitch, the most successful by far of the four movies we're going to be looking at this point. is the one film that Disney still talks about, for sure.
When I went to Disney World, I did go on a Stitch in Space something ride.
It had a bunch of sequels. It had too many sequels. It had so many sequels that I can't keep track, and apparently only one of them counts. I don't understand it. Maybe I'll find out more next time, but I am not looking forward to it. I am hoping that I don't have to watch more. I think the one thing I know about Lilo and Stitch, which is a movie I've only seen all the way through once, is that there's like a whole section of the film that got taken out. And so like Stitch's character development is like more implied, because a lot of the scenes where he would have mellowed out were just taken out.
Oh.
And that there's a sequence where Lilo is hiding in a dryer or something, and then they apparently have Star Wars special edition that scene into her just being like in a box or something, because they were afraid that kids would imitate that or something like that.
Yeah.
Those are the only things I know about this film. So I guess we'll find out more. Also, I think our buddy David Ogden Stylers is also in this film too. I say it's a trilogy. It's actually four movies though.
Yeah. A quadrilogy.
So we'll take a look at that and see if this movie is as good as people seem to think it was at the time. It wasn't good enough to save Disney Animation from going 3D. But apparently it's good. We'll find out. But yeah, we're going to head on out. Email us at adultsomethingsversus@gmail.com. Tweet at us at adultversus on Twitter. Message us on Facebook under Adult Siblings Versus. Our theme song is Sellout by Zombie Apocalypse Now from the EP Forbidden Tales of Science. You can find that and more at antizombierock.bandcamp.com. Okay, so Ario, I got a quick question for you. There was going to be any more adventure sequels starring this cast as they go on other adventures loosely based on science fiction literature, what would you like to see?
I would like to see Vinny explore. I mean, this isn't sci-fi, but I kind of want to see the crew explore Fraggle Rock, because I think I just want to hear Vinny say Fraggle Rock a lot.
Hey, Fraggle Rock.
I don't know. Yeah, something about it. I just want to hear him say Fraggle Rock a lot.
I would like to see them in the John Carter of Mars universe, because I just like John Carter of Mars. I think it's a fun franchise. It's a fun EP. It's a fun IP. It's too bad Disney blew it. In any event, I guess we'll try to contact Jim Henson Studios to see if they're willing to make a all Muppet Fraggle version of Atlantis, the Lost Empire, have Vinny interact with some Fraggles. But until next time, as always, please do not put a dirty sock in your younger sibling's mouth.
Yeah. My name is Kirakakash.
Kigashikas.
No. It's very easy. Ki.
Ki.
Da.
Da.
Ka.
Ka.
Kash.
Kash.
Kirakakash.
Kikapadapdu.